Rod Hill, FM News, 1 hour.
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails. We got to talk about what happened in North Carolina, because this has, well, this actually applies to just about every city that has mass transit, which basically means every moderate to large city in the United States. But this involves the horrific, well, the horrific crime, the stabbing of a young lady on a light rail train in North Carolina in the town of Charlotte. We got to talk about the latest developments in this, because this is more horrific than we thought it was in the first couple of days of this. Let me get into that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. As always, naysayers, you get to go first. If you call in and disagree with me, I'm glad to put you first in line. My producers know that's the rule. We've never deviated from it. It is always naysayers go to the head of the line. You want to send an email instead, it's talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in our X poll. Today's question, and it really bears on this case out of North Carolina and all the other violent crimes that have been going on in America, well, until Donald Trump comes to town, because you saw what he did in Washington, D.C., even so much that the Democrat mayor of Washington, D.C. now endorses what Donald Trump did. About a month ago, Muriel Bowser was condemning Donald Trump for taking over control of crime in D.C. Now she says we're going to work with him as an active partner in controlling crime in Washington, D.C. And I think that is exactly what a lot of these big city mayors and governors of states are worried about. They're worried that they have allowed this kind of rampant crime and crime at just an absolutely insane level of violence that happens to people in communities where transit systems are not safe, libraries are not safe. I mean, shopping centers are not safe. And you say, oh, but violent crime is going down. Well, violent crime went up dramatically during the pandemic. And an awful lot of those Democrats who brag about it coming down, yeah, it came down after it went up to the stratosphere during the pandemic. Yes, it's come down from then, but it's not really down from the level it had been at up to the pandemic. But let me talk first about Irina Zarutska. She is was a 23-year-old woman. And the reason I said this has become even more horrific, and there have been some new developments, because the federal government has stepped in to make sure that Charlotte, North Carolina, does not screw up the case against the man who is accused of stabbing Irina Zarutska to death on that light rail train in Charlotte, North Carolina. DeCarlos Juwan Brown Jr. has now been charged by the FBI, and that means that the case will go federal. That means that no matter how woke Charlotte, North Carolina is, the federal government, the Trump Department of Justice, will be handling this case instead of the local authorities. So the FBI is bringing the charges against him. But here's what I find especially horrific about this, because this young lady stabbed to death on a light rail train. You can see it on the surveillance video. Now, surveillance video doesn't always tell you the entire story of what happened, but in this case, I think it tells you plenty. A young lady wearing a baseball cap gets on a train. She's apparently on her way home from work, is what we understand about where Irina Zarutska was going. And yes, she's a Ukrainian refugee who came to the United States. Frankly, I don't think it matters where she came from. The fact is, she had a right to get on public transit and not be stabbed to death. And she's minding her own business. She's apparently studying the screen of her smartphone and sits down in the train, doesn't engage with anybody around her. The train isn't especially crowded. It isn't empty either. There is a man sitting behind her, the man who is now accused of murdering her. And again, those charges are going to go federal. What happens next, two things that I want you to notice. If you haven't seen the video, it is a bit disturbing to watch. But the man behind her calmly pulls out a pocket knife, opens up the blade. It wasn't a fixed blade knife. It was a pocket knife. And then he quickly leans forward, stabs her three times, and then rushes off the train. You see all this clear as day in that surveillance video. Now, that's bad enough. But what we haven't seen until today was this. Zarina Zarutska apparently did not know or didn't know what to do, didn't realize how badly she had been stabbed. She sits there on the seat, kind of draws her knees up toward the seat. You can see some blood spotted on her trousers, but really you don't see much more than that. She's wearing a black T-shirt, and you don't see that she is bleeding to death right in front of everybody. But what does happen, there is a woman sitting about 4 feet away on the opposite side of the aisle of the train, a black woman with a backpack, and she just sits there as the man jumps up, stabs this woman three times, and rushes off the train. And it's clear that Zarutska has lost her baseball cap. It was knocked off by her assailant, and she's now drawn herself up. I can't tell if she's crying or not or making any sound. There is no sound on the video. But as she's sitting there, there are three people sitting behind her on the train. Now, her assailant is black, and I think that plays a factor in this. The three other people on the train with her sitting behind her, who at least saw that a man had done something and then rushed off the train, and that she's now got her hat knocked off and is apparently distraught. Not in a great, you know, she's not screaming. You can tell that from the video, but she's sitting there, obviously not going anywhere. And the other four people, including the woman sitting 4 feet away to her right, just simply gather up their belongings and walk off the train. They don't appear to stop and say, are you okay? Do you need help? This is a young woman who is minutes away from bleeding out and bleeding to death. And the other passengers on the train who saw something happen, it sounds as though, or it seems as though, we've reached that point where this kind of random violence on transit, and you tell me a big city in America that does not have random violence on transit, it has become so common that people just simply say, I'm going to mind my own business. I'm not even going to ask this young lady who's well-dressed, I mean casually dressed, but well-dressed and apparently presents well and isn't causing anybody any disturbance. She isn't screaming and yelling like so many people you see in public. People who are homeless, people who are drug addicted, people who are mentally ill. She's not doing any of that. They don't even inquire, are you okay? Do you need some help? Now, we all know, anybody who knows basic first aid, and that's all I know is basic first aid, if somebody is bleeding, you put pressure on that wound. And maybe Irina Zarutska didn't realize just how badly wounded she was, but she was in the process of dying right there. And the fellow passengers on the train simply stand up, walk by her, not fast, it's not as though they're trying to escape, and the man who's accused of knifing her to death, he's already gone. He was gone seconds after he stabbed her three times, and the other passengers on the train, they do absolutely nothing. They don't stop to inquire. They don't stop to offer their help, and that woman just sits there and dies. By the way, Irina Zarutska, white, the other three people on the train, black, her assailant, black. And if you don't think that plays a role in how the other members of the public respond and how the news media covers or did not cover this for about 10 days, well, I take you as a naysayer, and I'd be glad to talk about it. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
With you all day, every day. Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're mighty well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense? nonsense.
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, let's start out with a few facts. Multnomah County operates a dangerous library in downtown Portland, despite tens of millions invested in that building. Lately, the bookhouse has become more of a homeless shelter than a service to citizens. So dangerous, in fact, that a man leaving the library who saw a disturbance outside and tried to intervene, he then got stabbed. His alleged assailants now face criminal charges, a trial, and one would hope time in jail. But the county chair, Jessica Vega Peterson, now demands that the district attorney release surveillance camera video. She also mentions the race of the assailants, all black, because somehow that means something to Peterson. She doesn't explain what it means, but she mentions it all the same. Excuse me, but the video was shot by library cameras. Cameras are public records, entirely controlled by, guess who? Jessica Vega Peterson. Either Peterson is a bit dense upstairs and doesn't get it, or for political reasons, she wants the video released by the DA and not by her. She's trying to tell citizens that the video shows a discrepancy between what is seen on the video and what is explained in the police reports. But she doesn't go on to explain what she thinks the discrepancy is. Seems clear to me. Somebody got stabbed. The alleged stabbers face criminal charges. And Vega Peterson still runs a library that is too dangerous for regular law-abiding folks to visit. Did I miss anything there? And by the way, in a related X post, the journalist Andy No, you heard him on this show plenty of times. He's a great journalist. Woke Multnomah County Chair Vega Peterson is coming to the defense of three black suspects accused of mobbing and attacking a white man with a knife outside the Central Library downtown on August 25th. Vega Peterson says there was a rush to judgment by police, and she's calling for videos to be released. Jariah LaQuince Williams, Anthony Michael Nicholas, and Davinia E. Anderson, all indicted for felony assault, felony unlawful use of a weapon, menacing, and other crimes. The stabbing attack follows the shooting death of a white man by a black male suspect named Hassan Muse outside the same library. And by the way, just in case you want to question Andy No, because we've had plenty of occasions for years to talk to Andy, Andy is gay. Andy is a person of color. Andy is a racial minority. And Andy does very good journalism. Our question of the day brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Jana writes in, Lars, have you noticed when you fill out most forms, they want to know your gender, your ethnicity, and your color? However, when the news is identifying a perp, they just say the suspect is wearing and what his or her hair color is. Funny, you don't think it's more important to ID the criminal rather than the poor sap filling out a form? And my favorite post on X today, Colin Wright, swipe right, Canada has outlawed carrying anything for self-defense beyond a whistle or a noisemaker. And now the city has banned home security cameras that view or listen beyond the perimeters of their property. Why do so many laws have side benefits for the criminals? It's also weird. How in the world does Canada expect people to put, say, a doorbell camera, which many people have on their homes? I don't have one, but many people do. You put up a doorbell camera. If your front door is only 20 or 30 feet from the sidewalk, how in the world do you have a camera that does not view beyond the perimeter of your property? I don't even think that's possible. It sounds like they don't want you to have any camera at all. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give the grill to all the lawmakers who are still getting paid every day during these special session. Oh, you didn't know there's a special session going on right now? You thought that happened over Labor Day weekend? Well, it started on the Friday heading into Labor Day weekend. We're now about 10 days past that, but the lawmakers are still getting their per diem payments. It amounts to $178 a day for every day that they're in session. And you say, but they're not meeting right now. No, they're not, because Senator Chris Gorsuch is still ill. He's recovering from some health issues and some surgery, apparently. They expect to have all of the members of the Senate and the House back by next week. The House has already passed a crazy new tax plan that the governor wants to pull billions of dollars out of the pockets of citizens, but the Senate didn't get around to voting on it, and they need Gorsuch back because they need every single Democrat vote they can get because Republicans are not going to approve it. But in the meantime, while the special session is on hold, all of those lawmakers are still collecting $178 per day in per diem because officially they're still in special session. Do you think those lawmakers should be collecting per diem while they're sitting at home or whatever it is they're doing right now? Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes. I had them do it for me, and it's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or call 855-CAP-THAT. Scott writes in from Tigard. Lars, Oregon has been a one-party state so long it has bred lethargy and complacency into the Democrats. They don't think they can actually be beaten in an election. That's why they just blithely put forward a new tax hike, kind of like it's an everyday occurrence. Will this tax bill be the final straw that breaks the camel's back? I hope so, especially if mail-in voting, you get rid of it. Well, Scott, I think you're right. And from your lips to whoever's ears, I would like to get rid of mail-in voting as well. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's go first to Ron. Hey, Ron, you heard me talking about the man now accused of stabbing Irina Zarutska to death on that light rail train, this one in North Carolina, but doesn't sound like the light rail trains in Seattle or Portland are any safer.
No, they're not. Not even a pool hall, Lars. You know what's funny? I've seen this happen 36 years ago when I was getting on a second deployment. This is right out of the Chinese manifesto under Deng Xiaoping. Once you plant seeds of defeatism in your community, when you got an incident of that nature happening, whether it's there, whether it's in the Islamic world, in Europe, Western Europe, they just become sheep to the slaughter, and they don't care. It ain't their business as long as it doesn't happen to them. When you start as a male, I feel ashamed that there was no defense of the woman or checking on her care or anything else. And it brings me to sadness that even right here in Oregon, that's the same thing, but it's pretty funny. You know me, I'm a Mosaic American. I got Cherokee, Creek, and Irish in me.
You got it all.
And the point is that, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't matter what color you are. If you did something wrong, you should be exposed and called out and put in the light of truth and accountable for it, Lars.
But, Ron, I kept wondering, what in the world stopped any of those pastors, especially the woman sitting right across the aisle from this young lady who was bleeding to death, from saying, are you okay? Do you need help? Now, she could have said that, and if Irina Zarutska had said, yeah, I'm bleeding, I mean, that woman could have got off the train and summoned medical help. I don't know if it would have stopped her from dying. She'd been stabbed so badly she bled out right there. But it didn't look as though her fellow pastors gave a damn about what had happened to her. All they know is, as you said, it wasn't happening to them. And that is a sad statement on, you know, it kind of reminds you of that old Kitty Genovese case where the woman was raped and then killed, and everybody listening in their apartments just sat there and didn't even pick up the phone and call 911. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. He's up before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. I really look forward to talking to Pierce County Sheriff Keith Swank, who joins me now. And Sheriff Swank, I feel a bit guilty because after you did the post last week saying, do you think it's time to ban trans people from owning guns? I thought about it, and I said, that makes a darn good X poll. And we put up a poll question every day, and we talked about it for most of that day. And now all of a sudden you find yourself under investigation. If I'm responsible for part of that, I apologize. But welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lars. You're not responsible for it. I wish I could blame it on you.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Sheriff, I've filled out plenty of 4473s, the form you have to fill out to buy a gun anywhere in America. And it always asks, you know, has the judge ever sent you to the loony bin? And I always say no, because I haven't had a judge send me to the loony bin. But I understand the idea is it was already illegal to sell a gun to somebody who's got defined mental problems bad enough to have been sent off to confinement in some way. And all you were suggesting is, hey, transgender is a mental health issue, as you said. And it sounded like it sounded pretty reasonable to me. Why are you being investigated then?
Well, because the left doesn't like to talk about that. They want to say transgender is normal. There's 47 genders, or is it 93? I don't remember how many genders there are now.
I've lost count.
If you believe you're something else, then it's okay. But if I were to say that I'm African-American, then it wouldn't be okay. So they have all these rules that they want me to abide by and you to abide by. And if we mix up any of their speech rules, then they'll hold it against us.
So, but you don't change your stance that maybe it is time to start asking the question. If somebody has mental health issues involving transgenderism,
yeah,
then perhaps they shouldn't be allowed to buy a gun.
Well, that's part of it. But the other part is, you know how the left wants to have gun control, right? So I want to put them on the spot. Like, do you want gun control, trans rights? What do you want here, right? So I thought that question was very provocative for people to say, oh, where are they going to go with this? What are they going to say? They're going to say, therefore, protecting trans to have the ability to have a gun. Okay, then I guess you're okay with everybody having guns then, right? So it was two questions in one question there.
And I can see that. And Sheriff, let me ask you this, because I want as few gun controls as possible. But most of them I don't object to. If people want to, you know, identify me with picture ID when I buy a gun, okay. I'm willing to do that for buying a gun or for voting too. But I'm concerned that people are not seeing the pattern that I see. And I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I see a pattern that we've had a disturbing number of mass shootings in the last 10 years, especially, and especially in the last 7, that involve transgender suspects who are supposed to be less than 1% of the entire population, but seem to be a disproportionate number of shooters like Minneapolis, like Nashville, and I could go down a list of other transgender-involved shootings. Do you see that pattern as well?
Exactly, and they're going to these places like these schools where the most vulnerable are, right? So what's going on? Let's talk about this. Let's have a conversation about it. I stand by it. People who are transgender who think you're a boy when you're a girl or vice versa, you have a mental health issue, and we need to give you some help. That's just the way it is. And so the left doesn't want to admit that. They want to say, we say anything like that, it's hate speech. I studied psychology in 1994 from University of Washington. It was gender dysphoria. It was a mental health issue then, and now it's not. So they just change things around and say it's not. Well, I'm not going to allow them to make up their new science and tell me new things, and then I'm going to go along with it.
No, and in fact, I guess if we had any other kind of pattern of killings, you know, when they identified the Unabomber but didn't know that it was Kaczynski, they said this guy seems to be attacking people who are tied to technology. So you look for both some kind of common thread among the victims, and you look for some kind of common thread that might indicate what kind of person does this kind of crime. And the fact that politically, they don't want to say it's transgender because that violates their political ideas and being woke and saying, no, transgender is all good. It helps people. I don't think it helps people.
Well, you know, what this really is, to boil this all down, the Criminal Justice Training Commission of Washington has been weaponized. And so they want to be able to decertify people who don't think their way. So in the decertification list on that subsection H, if you engage in any conduct, not limited to verbal statements or writings online, the basis of race, religion, creed. It goes down a whole list of things. So they can look at anything that anybody says and say, therefore, you're decertified now. And they put it right in the list of people who've committed felonies or things like that, right? So to them, it's as bad as committing a felony of armed robbery. If you misgender somebody, you're going to be decertified.
And so that's what they're threatening to do to you, that they put you under investigation by the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission, which is kind of like the state of Oregon's DPSST. They're the folks who certify you can be a cop. And if you don't have that certification, you can't be a cop, right?
Well, you know, it's funny, though, Lars, because who's the one that commissions all deputies for Pierce County, Washington? The elected sheriff. Nobody else. No one else has the authority to do it. So they can decertify me, do whatever. As a matter of fact, they took my pension whenever I got elected, which is another story. So they can decertify me, I'll get my pension back, and I'll still be able to be the sheriff. You don't have to be a commissioned officer to be a sheriff. They want to change it, make it that way, but it's not that way now. So that's their way to intimidate me, but I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not going to back down from them at all. I'll take this the whole way to the U.S. Supreme Court if I can.
You know, I want you to comment, and I know it's about another agency, but I want to ask you about this. So you're elected by the people, right, Sheriff Swank?
Yes.
Okay. In King County, they no longer have the people elect the sheriff. The sheriff is chosen by King County, correct?
Right.
Now, I see that as a deficit for King County because the sheriff is no longer answerable to the people of King County. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree, but the people voted for that. At least the people had the opportunity to vote for that, and they did. I think they're wrong, but they voted for that.
Do you think they knew what they were going to get, that they were going to get one more law enforcement officer chosen by politicians, which is what, I mean, with all due respect to the police chiefs out there, they all work for mayors and city councils, which means when you say, well, why aren't you doing what the people want, what the chief of police does is whatever the city council wants, not necessarily what the people want.
Exactly. I believe the people, unfortunately, in King County, they want to have an appointed sheriff. They want them to do the bidding of the executive, the council, because that whole county is lost, Lars. Your listeners know it. You know it. It's lost. I don't know if it will ever return to any portion of sanity again. I don't think it ever will.
So when are they going to tell you whether you're guilty or not? Or did they give you a guilty, not guilty finding on this?
Well, I have three investigations now for my online posting. I don't know when they'll tell me if they've officially started an investigation, but I look forward to it, you know, when they do their investigation because, you know, they're going to, if they call me in to give an interview or whatever, I'm looking forward to talking about that too. But I don't know when they'll do it, but at some point they'll go through it. The complaint rose to the level of, they say, if I violated this RCW, then I could be decertified, right? So for my speech and everything like that. So I'm just going to start posting on X about white males. Hopefully I won't be held accountable for that.
If you post about it, you can post about me, Sheriff. Post about me all day long. I'm a white male. You can go ahead and bash me up one side and down the other. Democrats do it all the time. But it must make you feel like you've become one of those British subjects, you know, where in Great Britain they're arresting people for silent prayer and for public speech. And now we're becoming Great Britain. That is Sheriff Keith Swank, who is the Pierce County Sheriff. He is under investigation for posts he made on social media. It should be interesting to see what they come up with at the end of that investigation. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And what do you do with a 13-year-old with 23 guns and plans to shoot up a school?
On demand, wherever and whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday live on the Radio Northwest Network and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So I frequently get the suggestion that would judges let criminals out of custody and then those criminals go out and hurt somebody or kill them, the judges should have some consequences. So we made this X poll. It was based on a few suggestions I got by email. If bartenders can be jailed for over-serving booze, should we jail judges who let criminals out who then kill? In other words, you let somebody out of custody while they're facing one charge for one kind of crime, and you could have foreseen that they would likely go out and be violent again. Should we have some consequence for the judges? I would say yes to that. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, yesterday's poll, should you decide as a voter whether public schools honor trans or honor the privacy of young women? Well, 89% of you said yes. We should get a vote on that. Brian Haywood is the guy who successfully last year sponsored six different initiatives in the state of Washington. The courts pretty well did a job on some of them. The legislature tore apart some of them. But the downside is that, the upside is at least we got to vote on it. The downside is the public officials don't seem to give a damn what you vote for as a citizen, but we've got to set them straight on that. But you can find that. We're anxious to talk to Brian Haywood one of these days about his plans to get that in front of the public and let us vote on it. I saw this as well today because, there's been a big to-do about the fact that the CDC and the FDA have now said, yes, we recommend the COVID vaccine, the one I didn't take, the one many of you decided not to take, or the one you decided to stop taking boosters for because you didn't see the value in it. I understand that. I've disclosed my dog in the fight. Well, guess what? Some of the doctors out there say, we're afraid to do something if the government doesn't tell us to do it. At least that's the way that I transcribe this headline from the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. Doctors are hesitant to prescribe or administer the new COVID-19 vaccine without the CDC's official recommendation on the shot. Now, hold on a second. You got an undergrad degree, then you went on to medical school, then you did your residency, and now you're out practicing medicine. But you don't want to do something unless the government tells you to do it? They quote Courtney Dresser, who is with the Oregon Medical Association, say the doctor's hesitation to prescribe vaccines comes from a place of caution and concern due to lack of clear guidance from the federal government and the state. I guess at that point I'd ask you, because it was the question I asked myself, do any of you trust the advice you've had in the last 5 years from the state and state health departments or from the federal government? I understand the federal government is under new management, but remember the legacy of Anthony Fauci and all the rest of those jokers in Washington, D.C. Dresser says that doctors are worried about liability and insurance coverage when prescribing for those eligible, as well as for what would be considered off-label use. This is the point I've been making all along. That when you see people like Bob Ferguson, governor of Washington, and Tina Kotek, governor of Oregon, and they say, well, if the CDC is not going to make recommendations, then we are. Oh, great. So your doctor is now taking advice from Tina Kotek? Does that sound like you're going to get good medical care in that case? I also wanted to tell you about this because there are a number of you who follow the antics of Sylvia Hayes. If any of you do not remember Sylvia Hayes, Oregon's one-time first lady, she was the governor's girlfriend, who apparently hates America and hates the president that we elected twice, and she isn't shy about bad-mouthing her country while she visits Canada. So Sylvia Hayes, associated with John Kitzhaber, girlfriend to John Kitzhaber until her influence peddling from inside of Kitzhaber's office forced him to resign 1 month into his historic fourth term as governor. Imagine this. You get inaugurated in January, and in February, you've got to resign your office because of your girlfriend's antics to make money by peddling influence from inside the governor's office. I would remind you that part of her history is she took $5,000 to get married to an Ethiopian man in an immigration fraud. That's a federal crime. She was partner in an illegal marijuana grow before it got legalized. And she committed multiple felonies from major marijuana operations before it was legal to influence peddling. What did she post online? She said, I just spent a week in British Columbia. Nice place to go to. It has been 25 years since I'd driven across the border. Over the course of the next several days, I had many heartfelt conversations with fellow competitors. She was at a dog competition. We frequently asked one another where we were from. I'd say Oregon. And once again, I'm enjoying being in a saner country for a little while. So she's describing Canada. as a saner country, the country that says you can't have a camera on your front porch. You can't defend yourself if somebody breaks into your house. Time and again, she writes, Canadians would respond with, it must be so terrible. I can't believe what's happening there. One younger woman said, from here, it all looks like the start of The Handmaid's Tale. It must be terrible. I told her it truly was. Now, she apparently hates the United States of America, but hasn't left the United States of America, other than the junket she took with John Kitzhaber back when he was still governor. She apparently dislikes the United States of America, and yet she still makes it her home, and she writes about it, and apparently when she does go to Canada, she's not shy about bad-mouthing the United States of America. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
For the fun.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You know, you constantly hear the public schools in the Pacific Northwest complaining about how they are short of money. And so it seems a bit ironic to me that where you have arrangements made that have been in place for decades, in some cases almost 100 years, to supply money for the public schools and do it from the natural resources of the Pacific Northwest, and yet Oregon in particular seems to miss every opportunity to actually do that. And in fact, at this point, there's a lawsuit going on to try to force the state of Oregon to do what folks arranged decades ago, saying we want to take the money that comes from selling trees off public lands, and we want to dedicate it to public education. Well, they haven't been doing that. They would rather spend all that money down in Salem. So Dave Sullivan joins me now, retired Oregon State University business professor, president of Oregon Advocates for School Trust Lands, and the author of Oregon's Constitutional Duties to School, and you can get that on Amazon. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Lars, for having me. It's sort of fun, but the promise that was made goes back further than the decades you mentioned. It goes back to when the state was founded in 1859. And for Oregon to become part of the United States, we had to agree that we would accept these lands for our school children in trust. And that's the trust that's being broken today. So it goes back, gosh, but that's 150 years.
Close to 160 years. So I'm glad for the correction. But tell me this. How is Oregon getting away with saying we're going to take common school trust lands, but we're not going to do the things that those lands are supposed to do, which is supply timber, grow new trees, have them cut down, and have some of that money go to the public schools?
Well, states set up rules about how, making it difficult to sue the state. And that's sort of understandable. No one wants to get sued. So they've got all kinds of rules, and we've been working for 4 years to get standing and jurisdiction, get past objections for sovereign immunity. And it's required 4 lawsuits and over $100,000 worth of money, much of which has come out of my pocket. But we're making real progress now, because the law is on our side. I mean, the state promised that these were lands that were going to be for school children, and then politicians see these lands as a political slush fund that they can devote towards their eco-supporters.
Anything they want to give it to, because it doesn't, they're not saying we're going to take this money and give it still to the cause it was supposed to go to. They can spend it on anything that comes out of the public treasury. Am I right?
That's basically what they're attempting to do. And the reason they're getting away with it is that school children don't vote, and school children don't file lawsuits. And so, if people don't stand up, if there's no good person that stands forward and says, hey, wait a minute, you made this promise, it's legally binding, you got to use it for schools, then they can do whatever they want. And you know, if you're a politician, you're getting paid for making your supporters happy. And if your supporters are a bunch of folks that believe that carbon sequestration is the best thing since the invention of sex, I guess, then they're going to, you know, downplay or forget about the trust and move forward.
Now, would you mind doing this for my audience? Tell them about the major victory you've just won in the lawsuit that you've been funding to try to get this straightened out.
Well, I talked about the objections that say you don't have standing or the court doesn't have jurisdiction, and sovereign immunity protects the state from being sued, and discretionary functional immunity. All of these words, they look like they're hard to imagine them being made up. But we fought for 4 years through four lawsuits to get a court to say, yeah, we'll look at this, rather than, well, you filed the paperwork slightly wrong, or we don't think that this is the right court for us to deal with. And we finally have got through to where the last Friday we got a ruling that said, yep, you've got standing, and all of these immunity things don't apply. And so we'll start looking at the merits of the case. And once they begin looking at the merits of the case, they're going to end up losing because Oregon made this promise. it's going to take a while, but we'll get there.
I mean, this is a contract that the state of Oregon effectively made when it became a state, saying, if you give us these lands, we'll hold them in trust, we'll use the money that comes from developing the timber and then selling the timber, and we'll put the money to use to school to educate kids in the state. That was effectively the promise, right?
Yeah, right. And, you know, nationwide, this happened to all of the western states, and in virtually every case, over time, there have been politicians that have popped up and decided that they wanted to use it for parks, or they wanted to use it for typically in rural states, it's the Republicans that want to give away free leases on grasslands and rangelands, and in the Democratic states, it's to protect wildlife or whatnot. But in either case, so it's not really a partisan issue. It's just that politicians like to steal from slush funds, and they view this as a slush fund rather than a promise or a trust.
Okay, and so Dave, your background as a business professor, could we be getting a lot more money out of these public trust lands if we started to cut them, but cut them in a way that you never run out of trees? In other words, you don't cut any faster than the trees grow, called sustained yield. Could you be doing a lot more logging on those lands and developing even more money for the public schools or for whatever purpose it goes to?
That's a softball question. The answer is obviously yes, and we used to do that. So the Elliott State Forest has generated over $700 million worth of funds for schools in the past. And so the Habitat Conservation Plan that they just signed in May, that is an 80-year plan, will allow them to cut only 17 million board feet per year. And to understand that, you have to understand that the forest is growing 75 million board feet per year. Okay? So basically, like one-fifth of what it's growing is going to be allowed to be harvested for 80 years. And that means four-fifths of it's going to get packed onto that forest as more and more carbon. And eventually, you can't just store more and more trees and more firewood in a forest without having it just blow up. Eventually, we're going to get east winds in some late August, like we had in 2022, when the whole state turned bright red from smoke, and the whole thing's just going to burn up, and they're going to say, well, gee, we didn't see that coming.
No, they didn't, but they're going to say, we're going to sell the carbon credits even if Mother Nature or a lightning strike or human-caused fire does a job on that forest at some point. Well, at least they're getting somewhere with the lawsuit. That's Dave Sullivan, retired OSU business professor and president of Oregon Advocates for School Trust Lands. Back in a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. We'll talk about the crazy lower federal courts next.
To all the wokey snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I'm loving the fight that is going on right now as the U.S. Supreme Court tries to, well, I don't know, knock down the lower federal courts, because these lower federal court judges have become a real problem, and I think Americans ought to know about it. We have almost 700 federal district judges, and they are supposed to have limited authority. It operates within their district. And yet, in the last decade or so, maybe the last couple of decades, these federal court judges have decided, why, I can issue an order, and I can tell the whole country that it has to be law everywhere in America. Now, even if you have a glancing familiarity with the federal courts in America, you understand that individual federal judges decide for their individual federal districts. And only the U.S. Supreme Court can set the precedent for the entire country. The lower federal court judges have not. Apparently, there are a bunch of these federal court judges that don't understand their relationship. In fact, some of them have been even openly calling for the U.S. Supreme Court to pay more attention to the way they look at an issue. Well, actually, they don't understand. If you're a lower federal court judge, and then the case is taken to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals overrules you, they have more say-so than you do. And then if the U.S. Supreme Court overrules the Court of Appeals, they have more say-so. Well, as the Federalist wrote, the U.S. Supreme Court delivered a win for the Trump administration in its bid to enforce immigration laws in California. That happened yesterday, and we talked about it just a bit. The ruling is the latest in a string of Supreme Court orders revoking overreaching injunctions by rogue lower court judges. Now, they've got to bring this under control. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, if they decide that they need to impeach a federal judge or two, I've often had people say, well, what do you do about these federal judges? I say, well, number one, they're appointed for life. That means the only way you can effectively remove them is to have them impeached by the United States Congress and then convicted in the Senate. So my suggestion would be that they need to pick one of these jokers, the one in Massachusetts. Then there's one in Massachusetts that's gotten way outside of his lane, way over his skis. They need to pick one of these jokers and then put them up for impeachment. Even if they're not convicted, at least it sends a message. But this 6-3 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, and what it had to do with was whether or not ICE agents could go into Los Angeles, California, and start arresting people based on reasonable suspicion. And if you say, well, who made that law? I'd say, well, the United States Congress made that law, that your reasonable suspicion based on the court decisions and based on the law that you can go ahead and arrest people for being illegally in the country. That is what the job of ICE is. CBP guards the actual border and within about 90 or 100 miles of the border, and ICE does what they call enforcement within the interior. Well, the injunction was issued by Mamie Frimpong, is a Biden-appointed judge, said that the plaintiffs would probably succeed in their claim that the administration's raids violated the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I'm not exactly sure how they thought that was going to work, but the Supreme Court issued a stay on that order, saying that it would stay in effect pending the disposition of an appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals. So the Supreme Court is telling that lower court, no, you don't get to order that. The stay will terminate if a potential petition from the government to the Supreme Court is denied, but otherwise it stays in place. And in fact, Kavanaugh's ruling on this, or Kavanaugh's what he wrote about the decision, The plaintiff's standing theory is especially deficient in this case because immigration officers use their experience to stop suspected illegal aliens or immigrants based on a variety of factors. So even if the government had a policy of making stops based on the factors prohibited by the district court, immigration officers might not rely only on those factors. So in other words, if you've got an experienced ICE officer and they say we use the totality of the circumstances, we look at who somebody is, we look at language, we look at a lot of different factors, and when you get to the bottom of all those, if you have reasonable suspicion to believe that the person is illegally in the country, then that person can be detained. And Kavanaugh went on to say, just as this court a few years ago declined to step aside our constitutionally assigned role to improperly compel greater executive branch enforcement of immigration laws, because the federal government was sued, and they said, you have to come in and enforce these laws. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to make them do that either. We must now likewise decline to step outside our constitutionally assigned role and restrict the executive branch in enforcement of the immigration laws. Consistency and neutrality are hallmarks of good judging. In other words, when somebody wants the federal government to do more enforcement or less enforcement, that is not for the courts to order. That decision is made by American voters at the ballot box. They choose personnel, and when you choose personnel, you choose policy. And as Sonia Sotomayor says, the Fourth Amendment protects every individual's constitutional right to be free from arbitrary interference by law officers. After today, that may no longer be true. For those who happen to look a certain way, meaning Latinos, speak a certain way, and appear to work in a certain type of legitimate job that pays little, because this is unconscionably irreconcilable with our nation's constitutional guarantees, I dissent. What she's saying is, if those ICE officers are only arresting somebody based on the fact that they look Latino, that they speak Spanish, except they've made it clear already that is not the way ICE is enforcing this. They use a lot more than that, and they meet the standard of the law. And if any illegal alien is arrested and they say all they knew about me was I looked like I was Latino, fine, take that one to court. Contest your arrest. Well, this has been a string of different decisions where the Supreme Court has had to slap down these lower courts and say, you're outside your lane, knock it off. A few weeks ago, as Federalist points out, the High Court stayed another injunction by a lower court judge that tried to stop the National Institutes of Health from terminating DEI grants totaling almost $800 million. They say this is now the third time in recent weeks that the court has had to intercede in a case squarely controlled by one of its precedents. So the Supreme Court has said, we set the precedent, you now have to follow it. And the lower rogue judges, they're saying, no, we don't. We can do anything we want. Well, no, you can't. Let's go to Nick. Hey, Nick, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, about that forest thing, you know, that was promised to our kids.
Yeah.
You know, more money for education. I think you're missing a fundamental problem with it, though.
The
way to make a problem worse is to throw more money at it without any control.
Oh, I agree. And I agree with you there. But, Nick, if the state of Oregon said to the federal government, we want to become a state, and they said, fine, we'll give you this land, but you have to use what is produced by that land to fund your schools. In other words, that's money that should be funding the schools, and that means they don't need as much money from other sources like Oregon's income tax or fees or other things. So that money should back and fill, shouldn't it?
No, you're absolutely correct. I agree. But what happens when that should have started from the beginning? But since it hasn't, now you're just adding another revenue source. Whatever the government tax never takes away. So
yeah, except for one thing, Nick.
If you add that.
If you elect sensible representatives, I'm not saying that Oregon or Washington have sensible representatives right now, but if they say, hey, we've got another $100 million over here, then that means we don't need to raise taxes to bring in more money for schools. Then that's up to the actions of your state lawmakers, and then you have to get a sensible bunch in Salem to actually do that right. Coming up next, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Which colleges in America are failing to protect free speech? We'll talk about that.
The Lars Larson Show. A reminder,
You are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, I know things have changed in the roughly half century since I last did some college. No, I didn't finish, and I didn't get my degree. I didn't stick around for the indoctrination part of it. But when I went to college, colleges were a place where you could say, well, you got free speech. You can have a Marxist professor of economics. You can listen to somebody who emulates Milton Friedman. Instead, you could have everything in the world. But these days, colleges and universities have become places that are so straight-laced when it comes to free speech that the free speech rights of even students are constrained seriously. I thought we'd talk about that with Sean Stevens, who is chief research advisor at FIRE. That's the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. Sean, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So tell me about FIRE's latest estimate of the free speech rights of kids on college campus.
Yeah, so we've been putting these rankings out since 2020, so this is year six. So I think we have a pretty good sense of who does somewhat well. Like I'll say somewhat well because they all leave room for improvement, and then who does fairly poorly. This year, the top three, Claremont McKenna College in California, Purdue University, and then University of Chicago, they've consistently done very well in our rankings, you know, with some dips here and there. It's kind of like the top 25 in college football. You know, sometimes you're number one, sometimes you're number five, but there are schools that consistently do well, well in quotes. We can get to that if you want. And then at the bottom, we got Indiana University, third worst, Columbia University, second worst, and then their sister college, Barnard, across the street is the worst college this year for free speech. The common thread with those three schools is the students seem to really think the administration's been pretty heavy-handed with how they've cracked down on protests over the past couple years.
Well, now that might cause people to say, well, hold on, cracking down on protests, is that the evidence that the college is not protecting free speech well, or is it evidence that they are protecting it by saying you can have a protest, what you can't do is shut the entire campus down to other students?
Yeah, so in the case of these three schools, I'd say, you know, with Columbia and Barnard, because they are kind of like sister schools, they're right across the street from each other, they're affiliated, although they're separate institutions. There's instances where, you know, the administration is probably in the right in calling in the police, et cetera. Students occupying buildings is not okay.
Right.
But there's other times where they've, you know, these schools have kind of punished student journalists and faculty members for things that are clearly protected expression. And so that those are things that impact them in the rankings. Indiana, on the other hand, I would say, you know, I think the main reason why students are upset with them, it's pretty clear from both survey responses and open-ended responses that students gave. When the encampment protest started, the administration got wind that students were going to set one up, and they picked a place on campus that in the 80s was the site of a very similar protest. Students built a shanty town to mimic housing in South Africa and demand the university divest from companies doing business there. This is basically a celebrated moment in the history of Indiana's campus as a great freedom of speech example. And so what happened in the spring of 2024 is, you know, the administrators got wind that this encampment protest was going to get set up. They changed the policies the night before, banning erected structures. They then called the state police in the next day when students went to set this up. They clearly chose this location due to the symbolism. And this might not be the fault necessarily of the administrators for sure, but the police thought it was a good idea to put some snipers on the roof of a building on campus. Uh-oh. The students definitely noticed. So I think that was a little excessive.
Yeah, I mean, if the police have been answering some, you know, there's a deadly threat on campus, we need snipers, I'm all for snipers, but not in a case like this.
Yeah.
So What makes the difference in colleges as to why they don't just say, look, we're going to honor all kinds of free speech and we're going to let people speak, but we're not going to let them come out and occupy a campus and prevent other people from getting on or off the campus. And the, most of these are, some of the ones you named are private, but some are public universities as well. So they're owned and operated and funded by the taxpayers.
Yeah, well, even the private ones, I'll say, we generally treat them all the same over here at FIRE, with the exception of like religious schools that have kind of specifically carved out different policies. Most of these private colleges and universities, in the student handbooks they, you know, make students sign and agree to, or faculty handbooks that they make them agree to, or the policies they put on the books, they basically guarantee freedom of speech.
Do they live up to that?
It's maybe... No, they don't. It's kind of, that's where we would get to, is effectively, I think what you have over probably going back to at least the 1980s, maybe a little bit before, but you've seen kind of a growing, and we have another separate report on this at thefire.org, but there's kind of this growing administrative bloat where the number of administrators has grown a lot. The number of tenured faculty has shrunk. The amount of money spent on students has not kind of kept pace with the number of money spent on like administrative salaries. And I think you have a lot of people that are more, you know, they're conflicted in how they're trying to enforce things on campus. They'll say out of one side of their mouth, like, yeah, we want to support an open inquiry, you know, people are free to say what they want, explore ideas that they want, but then they worry about the blowback they receive when a controversy erupts.
You bridged into an area that I think is a great area, and that is, how is it we have these gigantic bureaucracies? Are there any universities out there that actually run lean and mean and put most of the money in faculty that actually get in front of and teach students, and fewer people up in the corner office?
Not so much anymore. I mean, I think you have examples of like the University of Austin in Texas, I think, is trying to kind of go that way. But that's a new university that still has to, you know, get approved for accreditation, et cetera. So at this point, I would say, like, I don't think so. I mean, there's thousands of places that qualify as colleges and universities in this country. I think what most people think of, the number is probably more around like 750, 800 in terms of like what most people are thinking of. But at those, I don't think it's the case anywhere.
Because you'd think that taxpayers would say, we want to see that you're getting the greatest number of students educated. I understand you have to do publishing, you have to do research and all that, but you should be doing the job of educating kids. And if you're spending it all on cushy bureaucratic jobs where you get a six-figure income,
it's
crazy.
Yeah, well, it's both too. It's like you want students being educated, but you want our colleges and universities, at least the ones that are, you know, in the business of doing research, you want them producing cutting edge, top tier research too. So you want to be able to attract faculty that want to be in that space. And if they don't feel like it's an open environment, it's bad as well.
Okay, Sean, very quickly, we're at the end of the segment. Where can people find this list and check it out for themselves?
Rankings.thefire.org. We have a revamped brand new website. You can look at, like I said, we've been doing this since 2020. 2020 was a little weird, so that is actually not on the website, but every other year's data is. And if you're really interested in 2020, you can request it and we'll send it to you.
Very good. That's Sean Stevens, Chief Research Advisor at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. You're losing.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Try that in a small town.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. That's NickShivers.com for details. Now, I'm glad to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. For more than a quarter century, we have served the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And I'm glad to take your calls as well. Naysayers always go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our ex-poll question today, if bartenders can be jailed for over-serving somebody, getting them drunk, should we jail judges who let criminals out who then go on to kill? And we have far too much of that going on right now. Almost every single day, there is a brand new example where we say, well, somebody was hurt, somebody was killed, somebody was raped by a person who was in police custody, was handed over to the courts. The courts decided to let the person go. And now they're out running around hurting other people. And we say, why don't these judges lock these folks up? Does it take too much common sense to look at somebody's track record and say, if I let this person go, they are likely to go out and commit other crimes and probably not show up for their court date? That's a reasonable, reason to hold the person in custody. Today's ex-poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I want to tell you about this because this is crazy. Oregon Catalyst, which is the Taxpayer Association of Oregon, points out that in 1954, so about 70 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court said segregating school children by race is unconstitutional. And you say, well, duh, Lars, that was a decision a long, long time ago. Aren't we living up to that? Turns out we're not. As Catalyst Taxpayer Association points out, in Portland, segregation is back in vogue. A group called Albina Vision Trust, and we've talked about that group on this program before, it is a racist group. It is a group that says we advocate for black residents of the city. They are trying to get state contracts, which they will then give out based on the race of the person who owns the business. And if you say, but Lars, that's illegal. I say, yeah, it is illegal, but remember the environment we're in. We're in the Pacific Northwest. State of Oregon, basically owned and operated by the Democrat Party, party of slavery since 1829. Washington State, much the same. They have been promoting the idea of a Center for Black Student Excellence. They started doing this about 5 years ago, summer of 2020, and they got the Portland Public Schools, who always complain that they're short of cash. They set aside $60 million for the concept of the Center for Black Student Excellence in a $1 billion construction bond. The voters approved it, and $60 million of it goes for this proposed Center for Black Student Excellence. And if you say, why don't we just have a Center for Student Excellence, and it doesn't matter what color you are, 5 years later, that $60 million bucks is still sitting there unspent. The voters had already approved the $1 billion for construction bonds. They put the money aside, but they never could explain how one single building would advance black student excellence in a district that serves 40,000 students over 152 square miles. In fact, recently, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, Oregon Live, in an editorial, they asked the same question. How is this center going to help advance student achievement? Except in this case, it's being advanced based on the color of the students. And if you say, but the U.S. Supreme Court says you can't do that. You can't have a center that is aimed at white kids or black kids or Latino kids or Asian kids. You can't. I don't think you could even get away with having a center for excellence for females or males. And these days, the 65 other genders that we're told actually exist. But as they point out in the famous 54 Supreme Court ruling, Brown versus the Board of Education in Topeka, Justice Earl Warren, the Chief Justice, wrote for a unanimous court that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. But as the Taxpayers Association points out, Portland Public Schools no longer cares about equality. Their new goal is equity. Don't ask them to explain it. Well, I've asked them. I've asked the superintendent of schools to come on this program anytime, and the superintendent of schools has never said yes. I'd love to talk to any member of the school board, and we have over the years invited members of the school board to come on and say, why would you set aside a special school based on the skin color of the student, whether it's white or black or otherwise? Why would you do that? Does that make any sense? Or does it make more sense to say if we have kids who are advanced kids, you know, talented and gifted kids, they used to have tag programs for those kids. If you have kids that are lagging a little bit behind, some separate tutoring wouldn't be a bad idea. The state of Mississippi has lifted itself from almost the bottom of the list in education to about the middle, and they're on their way to the top 10. And how have they done that? They tutor kids. They give people a little extra assistance, but they don't give the assistance based on what color the kid is. They give the assistance based on whether or not the kid needs some tutoring. And in that case, it shouldn't matter what color you are or what gender you are. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars.
Ladies and gentlemen, you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Now, I think we're going to get a great opportunity. The state legislature is not going to give this, but Brian Haywood might actually deliver it through Let's Go Washington. Washington voters putting forth a ballot measure that would restore parental rights in schools and keep biological males out of girls' sports, except they're going to have to gather 400,000 signatures to get that thing on the ballot. But Haywood has already shown that he's able to get that to happen. Carlene Johnson joins me now, staff reporter at the Center Square. And Carlene, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Lars. Yeah, nice to talk to you. Yeah, here goes Let's Go Washington out there once again with a couple of really important initiatives. These are initiatives to the legislature, and you said the goal being lofty. They really only need, I think, 309,000 for each of these to qualify. But of course, you want to get way more than that, as some signatures will be, you know, thrown out for duplicates, that sort of a thing. So 400,000 is the goal.
Aren't the Democrat officials in Olympia going to do everything they can to kill this thing on signatures alone? Don't they usually do that in both Oregon and Washington?
Yeah, they have challenged that in so many cases. And so, you know, but you referenced the fact that for Initiative 2081, which was the initial initiative to the legislature, they, I think in 5.5 weeks or something like that, gathered like 456,000 signatures. It was a crazy amount in the shortest amount of time ever. And they were able to get that thing qualified. And the, you know, lawmakers in Olympia, Democrat majority, overwhelmingly approved it, knowing full well their intention was to come back and gut the initiative during the 2025 legislative session, which they did.
See, this is the thing that bothers me, Carlene. I've never served on a corporate board of directors. I don't know that I ever would. Although I guess if they offered me Hunter Biden money, $1 million a year for doing nothing, I might do it. But if you're on a board and you had, say, a department head said, we're going to do this. Okay, I'm thinking of this in the private sector. And you say, are you sure that the folks who run the company are going to like that? Well, let's take it down to the board and have them vote on it. I mean, I would think that if lawmakers actually thought they had the right idea about how to handle a particular problem, that they'd say, yeah, by the way, let's just, as the legislature, let's refer this one to the voters and they can tell us what they think. I think the only time they would not do that is when they suspect we're about to do something that the voters by a majority would oppose. Well, in that case, don't do it, except they don't want to be told not to do it. And I understand their attitude is, you've elected us to be your representatives. We will make smart decisions for you. Well, if you really are making smart decisions for the people, would you expect that the people would approve of what you're doing? If you suspect the people would not approve, then you probably shouldn't be doing what you're doing, right?
Well, and I think that you hit the nail on the head. They knew full well that if they put this to voters, if they put 2081 to voters, given the overwhelming support, and it was a nonpartisan issue. You and I have talked about this before. I mean, the issue of parents having, you know, a say in what's happening with their kids at school, parents wanting to know that, you know, okay, if my kid went to the counselor at age 11 and said, I think I'm in the wrong body, and the school said, yeah, you might be right, I'm going to take you to a medical appointment without your parents' knowledge. Doesn't matter where you come down politically, parents are going to say, hey, wait a minute, that's my kid. I need to know what's going
on. Except, Carlene, you and I both know that it does matter where you come down politically, because if you said, do you think most Republicans and conservatives would say, oh, that's fine, honey, you were born a boy, but if you want to be a girl, you can be a girl. We'll go down and get you the hormones and we'll get some body parts sliced off. You tell me that that is not an issue that falls along partisan lines.
Well, I would tell you from just covering this and being down in Olympia and sitting in many of these hearings over the last two legislative sessions on this, Lars, you've got as many Democratic parents down there saying, I mean, it certainly it's going to be more conservative parents that are going to, 98% of them or whatever, saying, yeah, I'm not okay with this. But it's still like a 70-30 issue even among Democrats. It is just the far left, many of them leading socialists, leading these education committees in Olympia, Lars, that are trying to say that they believe they know what's best. For crying out loud, it took Republicans got one thing pushed into HB 1296, which was the measure that undid the Parents' Bill of Rights that passed, which now Let's Go Washington is trying to undo yet again. The one concession that Democrats were able to concede to that Republicans pushed was to say, if my child is raped at school, touched inappropriately by another teacher or some other staff member, you got to let me know within 48 hours. That was the big concession that we got in HB 1296.
Now, shouldn't that have just been a matter of common sense? If your child has been violated in any way whatsoever, the parents should be told immediately. I don't even think 48 hours is fast enough, but that was their big concession. Okay, in that case, we'll tell you.
That was their big concession. Yeah, that was a big concession. And they log rolled some other stuff into 1296 that made it harder for parents to sue teachers and schools when something is done. And this was the other big thing that was thrown into this, Lars. Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction under the, you know, Chris Reichdahl can now withhold funds if a school district doesn't follow his edicts on all of this stuff.
Well, now, hold on. This is the same Reichdahl who'll scream bloody murder. I mean, this guy who says there are not just two genders. This is the guy heading the schools. And he'll scream bloody murder if Donald Trump withholds funds from the state of Washington for not complying with executive orders from the federal level. But he'll do the very same thing at the state level, and that's okay?
Absolutely, and there are anywhere between 9 and 12 school districts in the state of Washington. Of course, they've got like 295 of them, but between 9 and 12 of them have, you know, come out, and their school boards have publicly said they're going to stand with the Trump administration on this and not OSPI. And so, you know, there's a lot, and as you well know, you've got, you know, U.S. Department of Education, Department of Justice investigating the state of Washington and OSPI over this. So they're kind of thinking that law is going to eventually come down on their side. But that's the first initiative. The second one, Lars, equally infuriating me. I've got three kids, two are girls, and both played in sports. This one is going to require the protection of girls in sports. As you know, here in the state of Washington, we've still got lots of boys playing girls' sports. And this would make it so that anyone who's a biological male cannot compete with or against female students in certain, you know, athletic activities in our schools.
I don't even see why that one's controversial. In fact, Carlene, I'm waiting for some conservative school district say, let's put together a girls' volleyball team entirely made of rejects from the boys' basketball team. And they're all 6.5 feet tall, and they're all in primo shape, but they just didn't make the cut. And say, put them on a team, say they all identify as girls, and go out and just wipe the floor with a couple of teams and see how long it takes for the liberals to start saying, no, no, that's not what we meant. You can read her stories at the Center Square. She is Carlene Johnson, who's a staff reporter. Glad to have you on the program, Carlene. Thanks very much. Glad to get your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The 40th President of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you have blamed the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm going to get your phone calls here in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our X poll question today, if bartenders can be jailed for over-serving a customer and getting them drunk or intoxicated, I guess is the technical term, should we jail judges who let criminals out who then kill? I would answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Let me go to my first naysayer this hour, and that's Gordon. Hey, Gordon, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, hey, Lars, I don't understand why you're so adamant against the black classes integrated into schools because
segregated. You caught my objection wrong. I said I don't like segregation of schools. Neither did the U.S. Supreme Court 71 years ago when they decided Brown versus the Board of Education. Having black students in with every other kind of student in the school is good. I was objecting to having a segregated Center for Black Student Excellence. Should we have a part of the public schools that dedicates itself to simply making one particular racial group do very, very well? Yeah. That sounds like segregation to me, doesn't it to you?
No, it does not, because the black culture is part of America, and they have a special way of home environment is different. And I mentioned I was a tutor.
Different how? No, hold on. Different how? How is a black student environment different in any significant way from the environment of white students or Asian students or anyone else?
I'll tell you how, because in a home environment of black families, and I studied this social psychology, and you have a different home environment. You don't often have the same level of, you know, sitting down and do your homework because
how do you know?
Different. And
you're describing an entire group of people based on the color of their skin and saying, well, in black student homes, they don't tell their kids to do their homework. I'm sure there are plenty of black families where they say, sit down and do your homework.
I know it just sounds crazy, but a lot of books at UW, and they describe all these articles and all these things. Maybe UW was crazy back then, too, but saying it's a good investment to invest. If there's black kids,
why not just help every kid, no matter their skin color, do well in school? What's wrong with that?
Well, okay, so what about Howard University and all these black universities that do really well?
They call them predominantly black because they're not all black students there and haven't been for a long, long time. But, Gordon, I appreciate a naysayer. Let's go to Paul, who's also a naysayer. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, I don't think that the people who are anti-police and pro-crime are doing it because of either Trump derangement syndrome or just because they're party members. There are the three other reasons I think that predominate. First one, of course, I agree with you on that they're afraid that people will find out they can't do it themselves. But more importantly, they have an audience of people in these cities who have two or three, they're probably many family members and friends who are charged with crimes, and these family members are not going to vote for good law enforcement. The third reason is, as El Chapo said, the cartels or the gangs are bribing people on both sides of the border. They've been doing that, and they consider it part of doing business. Mm. So I suspect that many of those people are doing it because of very large campaign contributions. I think they're being bribed.
You think the Democrats are being bribed by the cartels to be in favor of crime? Okay.
Right.
That's an interesting theory. Paul, thanks very much. I'm not sure you're a naysayer, but I'm glad for your call. Let's go to Weldon. Hey, Weldon, you heard me talking about federal judges. What's on your mind?
Well, I think I got a solution for this.
Okay.
I think we should treat the judges like we treat doctors, where their victims can, like, sue them for malpractice. And the judges would have to buy, like, malpractice insurance. And what they would have to think about the person they're letting go and say, hey, this guy could cost me some freaking money, you know? It would be a little extra incentive there.
You'd have to get rid of qualified immunity, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Well, just put a different qualifier on it.
Well, and I think I know what you mean, but you know that a judge can say, look, I act within the authority of my office. My office is to be a judge. Somebody comes before me. He's charged with a crime. I'm supposed to set bail. I can set it high or low. If it's murder, I don't have to give him bail at all, but I can set the bail high or low. So I set it low on this guy. He goes out and kills somebody, and you're saying we should make it possible for families of that murder victim to then go against the judge and say, you allowed this guy out. He or she killed our family member, and you need to pay us some compensation, and make the judges a little more thoughtful before they release bad guys back to the street.
Absolutely. It's like a doctor. Doctors make, I made a bad decision. I didn't mean to make a bad decision, but they still get sued over it because, grandma died, and they're just wanting to get the money.
And sometimes it is the doctor's fault, and sometimes it's not, but it's not a bad idea. Liability insurance for bad judging. Let's go to Michael. Hey, Michael, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, Michael, normally in Las Vegas, but driving through beautiful Utah right now on my way to a job in Idaho that we've been told for 50 years most Americans won't do, and that's probably true, but I'll find out myself. I'm going to pick potatoes and improve my Spanish skills, or sort potatoes. They may even let me drive one of their trucks, because if you're driving a private land or empty county roads, you don't have to have a CDL. So I've driven big trucks before, like trying out for truck school. So wish me luck tomorrow or Thursday or whenever I get there.
I will wish you luck, but Michael,
little place north of Idaho Falls.
Haven't we just completely blown up that notion that illegal aliens only do the jobs that Americans won't do? They do some very attractive jobs. I mean, the latest group...
I'll stipulate that we need some of them, Lars, but we don't need all of them.
No, hold on.
Like,
why do we need any illegal workers at all?
Well, to get everybody to do those kind of jobs, you double the price of food just on labor costs. But
no, can I do some math?
You said that on the air before.
No, but can I do some math for you? Michael, when you walk into the produce section of the grocery store and you pick up any piece of produce, do you know how much of that cost? So pick something like, cucumbers, and you're going to pay 99 cents for a cucumber. You know how much of it went to labor?
It varies greatly from crop to crop.
It does, but the overall average is 20%. So if the dollar cucumber was going to cost 50%, say you raise the wages for people who work picking cucumbers or processing cucumbers by 50%, it would add 10 cents to the cost of the cucumber, because the labor cost is about 20% across all the produce. And if you increase the wages dramatically, So instead of paying, I don't know, in most states you have to pay at least minimum wage. So say you're paying $15 an hour and you bump it up to $22 an hour, it might raise the cost of that cucumber by 10 cents. On the other hand, getting rid of the illegal alien frees us from all kinds of other costs that we pay for through our taxes. I think at the end of the day, it's a wash or maybe even a positive for Americans. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Gun Control Explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Now, I'm reasonably sure that Sonia Sotomayor is not a regular listener to this program, but I thought maybe if we got Hans von Spakowski on from the Heritage Foundation as senior legal fellow there, he could set her poor, disturbed mind to rest about the notion that ICE is simply roaming around big American cities and arresting people simply because they look Latino or they speak Spanish, because that's the way her dissent laid it out. Hans, welcome back to the program.
Lars, thanks for having me back.
I'm glad to have you back. So what did you make of Sonia Sotomayor saying, why now ICE can just go out and arrest people for looking Latino or speaking Spanish? Is that the way it's working?
No, it's not working that way at all. What federal immigration law provides and what the cases said interpreting it is that ICE agents, they can briefly detain someone if they have a reasonable suspicion that they may be here illegally. And what they were doing in L.A., as actually Justice Kavanaugh points out in his concurrence, is that where were they going? They were going to job sites that are predominated by illegal aliens because those particular job places don't usually require any kind of paperwork. So what was he talking about? Construction, landscaping, agriculture, car washes. He specifically talked about that, and there's nothing discriminatory about it, particularly, and she says, well, they're targeting Hispanics. Well, 75% of the illegal aliens in the country are Hispanic, and in the L.A. area, it's a much higher percentage. And if I shows up, for example, at a construction site, and the person has no paperwork, they're Hispanic, they don't speak English, that's a pretty reasonable suspicion that they may be in the country illegally.
Yeah, you would think so. And, you know, is it fair to say neither one of us can read the mind of Sonia Sotomayor, nor do I think it would be a good book. But she understands all this, so she's just simply saying what her political allies in the rest of the country want her to say, to try and say this is indefensible to arrest people. There's no reasonable suspicion. She knows what's going on, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. And, in fact, the district court judge out in L.A., a Biden appointee, who issued this widespread injunction basically saying you can't enforce immigration law in the L.A. area. Come on. Why did she do that? She knew she didn't have any legal justification for that. She just thought, well, the mayor, the governor, they haven't been able to stop this, so I'll use my power. I'll abuse my power as a federal judge. I'll stop it. That's what was going on.
And Hans, I can't count the number of times now that the U.S. Supreme Court has had to slap down, and I'll describe it that way. I mean, ordinarily you'd say, well, this decision was made by, say, the Ninth Circuit Court, which is crazy, and they get overturned all the time. But this is something different where these activist judges are doing this, and the Supreme Court, I thought, was trying to send the message, don't do this stuff anymore, especially don't do these nationwide injunctions. Is that message not getting across, or are we going to continue to see these activist judges for the next 3.5 years?
It is not getting across because these judges, look, they're very arrogant, particularly this judge in L.A., and I think their view is that I can do whatever I want, maybe, probably, it'll get overturned by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. But in the meantime, I can delay the Trump administration. And talk about the Supreme Court being busy. They've issued more emergency stays this summer than I have ever seen in the entire time I've been observing the court, which is more than two decades. That's how bad the lower court judges are who are acting against the Trump administration.
And I suppose if the U.S. Congress, I know they probably don't want to get in there, but I've explained to my audience the only way to get rid of federal judges that are appointed for by life or for life is they have to be impeached. Are we going to have to see them pick one judge who's gone especially over the line and say, we're going to impeach you, or would that just turn them into one more celebrity for the left?
Well, it probably would turn them into a celebrity, but there's actually an alternative to impeachment that only requires a majority vote. And this is something that Thomas Jefferson did. Remember, when Thomas Jefferson came in, John Adams and the Federalists appointed all these federal judges right at the last moment. And you know what what Jefferson and his folks did in Congress is, instead of impeaching those judges, they eliminated those judgeships. And so far, I haven't heard anybody consider that as an alternative. You know, if you have 10 judges in a particular district, you can pass a law saying, well, from now on, there will only be 8 judges in that district.
and you simply eliminate the job.
Yeah, you eliminate the job, and you put in a statute that the last judges who were confirmed will be the ones whose jobs are eliminated, which, what does that do? It gets rid of all the Biden judges.
Well, and so why aren't the Republicans floating that idea, saying this is what we could do, and we could do it in a bunch of jurisdictions? And say, because is there any required minimum staffing for the federal courts at this point other than that law?
No, it's up to Congress. They decide how many judgeships there are. It would take bold political maneuvering to do this, and so far I haven't seen that.
Now, hold on, Hans, just for procedure, so I'll get it wrong otherwise. It takes a majority vote in the House and a majority vote in the Senate. Is that all it takes?
Yeah. Now, they'd have to overcome potentially a filibuster of the legislation in the Senate, but still, that would be a lot easier than the two-thirds necessary to impeach somebody, convict them in a Senate impeachment trial.
Would doing one of them, simply picking the most pernicious one and saying, okay, we're eliminating your job, would that maybe put a shot across their bow and say, go ahead, keep it up, and we'll keep eliminating judge spots?
Lars, I think that would be a terrific strategy.
Just, and I don't know whether to pick the one in Los Angeles or that knucklehead in Massachusetts.
And
again, this stuff is going so fast, Hans. That one, what was he, 3 or 4 weeks ago? But things are going so fast, we've kind of forgotten about him.
Yeah, no, it's constantly happening. And the places it's happening are Massachusetts, California, Maryland, and the District of Columbia. That's where the worst federal judges are.
Okay, pick one of the ones in D.C. And, you know, because D.C. seems like a weird animal right now. When you saw Muriel Bowser go through the kind of John Fetterman transformation from I don't like
right.
Trump helping me with crime to I love Donald Trump and we're going to be partners for the next 3 years in defeating crime, that was amazing.
It was, but it was hard for her really to deny the fact that the rate of crime in the city, everything from carjackings to murders, dropped drastically. And that's something that even residents who support the Democrats, quietly, not to a reporter, they'll admit to you, boy, it's been great.
Yeah, well, let's keep it going great. And maybe they can take a shot across the D.C. federal Judge Bao and see if we can send a message to the rest of them. That is Hans von Spakovsky, who's a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. As he said, he's been following the federal judges and the courts for the last 20 years. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest. Hey,
I know y'all think it takes balls to be singing what I'm singing, but I'm just saying what you're thinking.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. This segment of the program is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And if you want to sound off, today's the day, 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, I'm glad to put you first in line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You know, one thing that came out involving the murder that happened of that young lady in Charlotte, North Carolina on light rail that ought to be a warning to both Seattle and Portland. Seattle has a light rail system. It is a colossal waste of money, billions of dollars spent on a system that's not very flexible, always goes over budget, and never carries the number of people that it forecast to carry. Portland has the same problem. They have constantly made promises, oh, we'll carry tens of thousands of people, and that gets them the federal money. Then they spend the money, and they create a system that only carries a fraction of what they promised, and they say, oh, sorry about that, little boo-boo. Well, guess what? The Transportation Secretary, Sean Duffy, is now saying USDOT will investigate what happened in Charlotte, North Carolina. So this is the federal government taking its appropriate role. The FBI has now charged the man who is alleged to have stabbed to death Irina Zarutska, one of the most disturbing pieces of video you would ever see. This young lady just sitting on a train. Man stands up behind her, unfolds a pocket knife. It's like something out of a movie. He then stabs her five times in the neck and then runs off the train. Now, her fellow passengers stand up and walk off the train. One of them apparently tried to chase the suspect. The others just walk by her. And I looked at the video. It was very disturbing. But in about 10 seconds from the time she's stabbed to the time she just collapses into the footwell of that seat, it is one of the most disturbing things you've ever seen. Well, now USDOT, this is a difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration that we suffered through for four long, terrible years. The Trump administration in DOT is now saying, we're going to investigate. And if we find that there is a soft-on-crime transit system that allows horrific tragedies like the one that happened in Charlotte, North Carolina, Sean Duffy says, you are not going to get federal money at all. Zero tax dollars will go to soft-on-crime transit systems. Now, if you were one of the operators of TriMet in the case of Portland, in Sound Transit in the case of Puget Sound, I think you should be very, very afraid. Both of those systems don't go anywhere without federal money to fund their capital projects. And if Sean Duffy, the Secretary of Transportation, is saying, if you're soft on crime, you're not getting federal money. And I think that reporters in both Seattle and in Portland should be down there banging on the door of TriMet and Sound Transit saying, what do you think of what he's saying? Because I think both of the systems, Portland is probably worse than Sound Transit. But in the case of Portland, we've had multiple violent events that are associated either with the light rail trains or the transit stops where those trains stop. It's a terrible, terrible system right now. People are afraid to ride it, and their ridership is dropping dramatically. And if the Secretary of Transportation is now saying, you're not going to get the money because you've allowed a soft-on-crime approach. And if you say, well, Lars, what would you do differently? I'll tell you what. I'm not a transit expert, but I know this. if you start doing fair enforcement, and if you're saying, Lars, we're talking about violent crime and fair enforcement. Do you know what fair enforcement does? If you have people on those trains who go through the trains and buses can, this can apply to buses as well, but it mostly applies to the light rail trains. If you start checking to see if people have their fare, and if they don't, you run them, and when they come back with wants and warrants, because they're wanted criminals, because they're violent people who've been excluded from mass transit because of their violence, then you take them into custody. If you do that fair enforcement, violent crime goes down dramatically. Instead, what TriMet and I think Sound Transit want to do instead is simply ignore it and make it a place for homeless people to sleep, for people to use drugs, to the point where Seattle bus drivers and Portland bus drivers are literally exposed to measurable amounts of fentanyl and methamphetamine smoke that ends up on those buses and trains. If that's the kind of system you're going to run, it sounds like you're not going to be getting diddly from the U.S. Department of Transportation. And if you understand all these systems, like the light rail line that they'd like to run across the Columbia River on the brand new bridge that will probably never be built, well, they're only going to get those things built if they get federal money. And it sounds like now one of the measures about whether or not they get federal money is going to be whether or not you run a soft on crime system, like apparently Charlotte, North Carolina, or whether you go out and you get serious about protecting the people who ride your system. And if you're not going to do that, you're not getting the cash. And I just heard from John Lee, who we frequently have on to talk about transit issues. He said, Lars, and because I got a response from the Coast Guard, they said that the Interstate Bridge Project has not even bothered to submit a permit request. Now, right now, the Coast Guard says that new bridge has to be 178 feet tall to clear river traffic. Right now, TriMet proposes to build it at 116 feet, about 60 feet short. And what John says is the Coast Guard has not received a bridge permit application. They don't expect to get it till January. Then they have 90 days to evaluate the request. Bottom line, this is required before the federal government can issue a record of decision. So it pushes back the return of decision.